Welcome to the Fan Experience Experience with Darren and Mark and a special guest.
Hello and welcome to the Fan Experience Experience, the podcast that explores the power of engagement in football and other sports. Join me, Mark Bradley, and my co-pilot, Darren Young, as our guests tell us their stories and share what they've learned. In season two of this podcast, we're exploring fan engagement post-COVID, and we're uncovering new ideas to help your club, league, or association to prosper amidst all of the uncertainty as we emerge from this horrible pandemic. Darren, talking about the pandemic, it's interesting to note that in recent days, there's been a little bit more on people starting to reckon that football shouldn't make assumptions about all of the fans returning after COVID. It's something you and I have talked about, isn't it?
Yeah, I desperately didn't want to go into the told you so mode. But yeah, I mean, I think we said this right at the very start, that there's just too many things that make it difficult for fans just to go back exactly as they were. And I think people are starting to realise that now. And it's not just a health thing. I was speaking to someone yesterday who had a call with someone who was saying that because of the pandemic and because of all the things that have happened, they've actually moved to a completely different part of the country. So their journey to matches, and they're a season ticket holder, or have been for several years, would now be 100 miles further than it was originally, which was already about 50 miles. So suddenly they're thinking, well, would I travel 150 miles there and 150 miles back every single home game? So suddenly it's a completely new question.
Yeah, and as people will know, if they don't know, on www.fanexperienceco.com, we've got a white paper that we put together last August, anticipating some of these issues and perhaps pointing out some of the areas that clubs could focus on. And of course, this is going to be a challenge for the women's game, and we're delighted today to introduce Polly Bancroft from Brighton and Hove Albion, where she is the general manager of the women's team. She's previously worked at UEFA, and also at the FA here in England too, but as well as an administrator of great experience and talent, she's also a player and a coach too. You're responsible for the under-17s, I believe, at Leeds United some time ago. And another connection that we have is the last time me and Louise went to take in a game of football, it was at the glorious surroundings of Brighouse Town, where Polly also played. Polly, lovely to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. Thanks for the slightly embarrassing introduction as well.
Oh, we specialise in embarrassment. It comes from the reasons we follow our football clubs. But how's the first few months gone at Brighton then?
Yeah, it's been really good. The people have been really welcoming, lovely introduction. Great to get to know all of the staff and the players as well. So, a really nice introduction, thanks.
Well, you and I obviously go back some years and our paths have crossed at various times. And we were conscious that at the start of the FA Women's Super League back in 2011, you know, clubs were going to have to innovate to kind of grow that audience beyond maybe the friends and existing enthusiasts and the players' contacts. And I've had a couple of visits down there to see them play, and it really is a good experience. I mean, I remember early on there being a photo booth, you know, provided where you could actually take a picture of yourself against a backdrop, you know, of the team, the players, or even the mascot. And, you know, that's something that's only just coming into the men's game. So to see it there at Brighton, you know, for us, our ears always prick up. So is that something that's constantly on your mind, you know, innovating to stay ahead?
Yeah, and I think just to your first point, Mark, in terms of the audience of women's football, I think traditionally people have thought that the main audience is women and girls that like to come and watch women's football. But really, we feel that women's football and the team in Brighton have outgrown that audience, particularly when a lot of women play at the same time as the Super League at 2 o'clock on a Sunday. So we need to think a bit more broadly in terms of, you know, who might be interested to come and watch the Super League. So really we're trying to target, or the insights say 16 to 34 year old men and women who play once a week are most likely to be interested in coming to watch a Super League game. So that insight that we were given from the FA was really quite interesting in terms of how we look to grow our audience and how we target those people. So really I've been working with our marketing team to look into how we can reach out to people that play once a week and encourage them to come and have a look. then once we've got people to come and have a look, the idea is to make sure that they enjoy their experience and they come again. Now, during my brief tenure at the club, we've only had two matches open to fans, and that was a home game against Chelsea and home against Reading as well. So we've had very limited access and to our audience, to our fans. So it's been such a shame that we've been limited to just those two matches this season. And, you know, we're really trying to do a lot of work behind the scenes to make sure that we've got a good experience in place for when the doors can open again. But it's something that we're continually looking at to make sure that the experience is as good as possible. And we do surveys for every match day to get fan opinions to make sure that we're continually improving and listening to what fans have to say.
Holly, one of the biggest challenges must have been taking on a role during a pandemic. What's that been like in terms of how you've been able to start in the position, given all the things that are different in the world at the moment?
Yeah, I suppose starting at the club where matches were being played behind closed doors gave me a bit of time to plan. But then we were only given about a week's notice that fans were allowed back again. So, you know, we were constantly maybe putting some meetings back because we didn't know when we were allowed to have fans again. So I suppose a bit of planning time, but then when it came down to us hosting Chelsea, not actually that much time at all. So we've been doing a bit of work in the background, speaking to key partners, trying to come up with some ideas of fan engagement and trying to increase the number of people that come and watch the matches. And then to be quite quickly closed down again and revert to matches behind closed doors, it's definitely been a strange and very fluid situation to adapt in. But I think now that we know we've got more time again to plan, that's a bit of a luxury that you wouldn't usually have. Whilst it's obviously a massive shame that we can't play matches with fans there, it's trying to promote other ways that fans can be engaged. So either watching on the FA Player, interacting with social or through social media. There's other things that we can do to make sure that that conversation still continues between the club and fans. But I suppose it's just a bit of luxury for planning.
What really stood out, Polly, when you had those games against Chelsea and then Reading, what stood out about the way that fans sort of experienced the game under those circumstances?
Do you know, it was really nice to see fans there. Obviously, it just looked a bit odd with the social distancing. Mm-hmm. But particularly for the Chelsea game, there was a great atmosphere. It felt like people were just so pleased to come back and enjoying that opportunity. And it was a great game and quite close as well, with just a 1-0 defeat. So, I just maybe a bit of a relief of some normality, I think, across the board. And, you know, we want to continue that moving forwards as well.
I think one of the benefits that Brighton have is your experience, you know, as kind of the national responsibility you had at the FA. And then, of course, the European responsibility, you know, for growing the women's game when you were at UEFA. And, you know, one of the characteristics of the approach was that planning and that very clear targeting. And, you know, we worked together in Denmark and also in Norway in the women's game there. And certainly in Denmark, as they're further down the road, that really did help them to be very clear, very specific about who it is they're trying to get, you know, into come to games and to connect with the club. And I think, you know, Darren, in all our many years working in the men's game, have seen that that often doesn't go on. You know, for example, right now, you probably wouldn't be surprised to learn that we find very little evidence of clubs actively engaging with fans to understand, you know, what are your attendance habits likely to be, you know, when we can finally get you back into the stadium. But going back to that idea of planning and working really strongly on branding and how you're actually going to engage the community, that really has paid dividends across Europe. So is that going to characterise your approach moving forward?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there are various themed matches that we're thinking about planning. So something maybe with the County FA for grassroots clubs, one for Wildcat centres, maybe looking into the commercial five-a-side space as well. So various ideas that we've got, also taking into consideration the international breaks on the men's side of the game to try and get some, you know, additional focus for the women's fixtures where there's a break in men's team matches. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's a lot of options that we can do. We also know that there's an unofficial supporters group for the women's team. So we're looking to make steps to make that a bit more official and form a formal relationship with that supporters group, because there are so many passionate fans out there and we don't yet have a formal link with them. So we're really going to tie that up, particularly with Euro 2022 taking place next summer and the opportunity that that poses for the club. We'll be hosting three matches at the Amex for that tournament. So really trying to plan ahead and maximise that opportunity to ensure that the fans that are enthused by Euro 2022 stay on and come to Crawley and watch the women's matches there.
Yeah.
Holly, when you said earlier that you'd gone and sought some feedback from fans as well, and me and Mark are always just astonished at how few clubs actually do that. I just wondered I don't know if you've got the information back yet, but what sort of things, if you have, are coming through from fans, and what sort of things are they telling you?
Yeah, that survey covers things like comfort levels, particularly during the pandemic. So how comfortable are they coming to the ground? How good was our communication pre-match with regards to the steps that the club has taken to make sure that it's compliant to the protocols, and even going above and beyond that to try and make sure that fans are confident that and comfortable to come to matches with what's going on. So we've got that element to the survey, but then regular points in there. So the normal touch points that the club would have with a fan, you know, from advertising the game, their ease of purchasing a ticket, their experience of the website, ease of parking, but any food and beverage responses. So it's quite a broad survey, and it allows us to try and adapt our offer throughout the season rather than just, you know, nominal responses or from season to season. But it we try and make sure that we can flex to that feedback quite frequently.
One of the areas that we're really fascinated in, and obviously you and I have talked about this in the past, is club identity. You know, the purpose of the club, in as much as, you know, transcending football and actually having a social and a community purpose, and the values that go with that. And in football, it's been very much a kind of a hidden thing that fans understand intrinsically, or sometimes have their own personal understanding of intrinsically what, you know, what their club means to them, and, you know, what Forest means to you, what Sunderland means to me, what Walsall means to Darren. In women's football, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because there isn't such a massive geographical spread of clubs, so there isn't that as much the need to, you know, be really unique and different so that you compete well with a rival in your town. And also the women's game, arguably, is completely unique in itself. It doesn't have the kind of cultural handcuffs of the men's game, with things like, you know, the type of antisocial behaviour you sometimes get in terms of chants and aggression. So, what's happening at Brighton? How do Brighton see themselves both within the club itself, Brighton & Hove Albion, of which you're part, and also in terms of, you know, how you see yourselves as being unique? I mean, if you understand where I'm coming, do you have a kind of clear identity? Do you have a set of values with that, or is that something you're developing?
It's certainly something we're developing, and it is a very hard question to answer. And this is where fans are integral, because they probably have a quicker answer than myself, who's quite new into the club. But I think certainly from my early experience, you know, even the nature of the fact that we're playing at Crawley Town, that's a red stadium, offers challenges for our identity. Clearly with the men playing at the Amex, which is, you know, a lovely stadium nestled into the South Downs, gives it some strong identity there. But yeah, I think, you know, Brighton being quite a liberal city plays its part. The club has always activated very strongly around the Rainbow Laces campaign, obviously with the nature of Brighton and the support and focus of the LGBTQ+ community. There's a thread of that within the club as well. So it's a difficult question, because we don't have set brand values that, you know, some other clubs may do. And it's certainly something that I'm keen to do, and it has to fit in. The women's values have to align certainly with the men's and within the club structure. But yet there are unique selling points for the women's team that differ to the men. So things that you alluded to, whether that's affordability of the ticket, the players are very relatable, those kinds of things. There's definitely uniqueness, yet it should still fit within the Brighton brand values as a club. So it's a piece of work that we are undertaking. It's not an easy one to pin down, but you know, each individual fan, like you say, will have their own reasons and rationale as to why they support Brighton rather than Crystal Palace or West Ham or Chelsea, for example.
It is a really interesting area. I mean, you know, as you say, that, you know, supporting the local women's team in itself is something quite edgy, you know, for certain groups out there. They feel kind of they feel that sense of belonging simply because they're getting behind, you know, women's football. And, you know, that's definitely a valid reason. And we were chatting to Daniel Lambert from Bohemians the other day, and that, you know, that's a club that have a very unique set of values, and talking about how, you know, if you're a big club and you're looking to have a regional profile, then when it comes to your values, they have to be kind of engaging, they have to be non-controversial, but at the same time, unique. And then there's the Bohemians approach, which is to actually go very subculture, you know, so to be to campaign politically for a particular view, you know, to have a strong, for example, supporting refugees, supporting women's right to choose in the recent referendum in Ireland. And I guess the women's game is still in that position where it could go any number of ways. You know, club could decide to go down these paths. So it's definitely an interesting time. So Darren, you next. What would you like to ask Polly?
Yeah. So, Mark, could I just maybe come in on there? Because I think the values is probably a key one for Brighton. Obviously, it's the MX Community Stadium. Mm-hmm. You know, they've done a huge amount of activations this year or last year throughout the pandemic to support the community. So I'd say that's definitely within the fabric of the club.
Yeah.
You know, they're certainly a very integral, or you know, have a lot of integrity within the community, and treat people very well. So I think that sort of, whilst it might not be, you know, written down anywhere, I think there's definitely that feeling across the community and within the club as well.
I mean, my next question, Polly, was going to just widen it out a little bit to the whole way that sort of women's football and actually probably women's sport as well has sort of fared during this sort of last, 10 months or 11 months, with the pandemic? Because from an outsider looking in, it sometimes feels like it's not quite given as much priority. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on there, and if you agreed with that, and what it's like within a senior role in the club to constantly be fighting to try and get women's football to the top or near the top of the agenda.
The club at Brighton is so supportive, and you know, it was so refreshing to hear that throughout my interview process, and that's really been my experience since I've joined the club as well, is that there's really open doors. It's more, I suppose, a case of understanding and learning more about the needs of women and girls and the different approaches that might be needed to fully integrate a female pathway within what was up until recently a very male-focused, male-dominated area. So I don't think there's any, I wouldn't say I'm fighting any battles by any stretch. It's more a case of, you know, trying to understand some unique differences for females rather than males. So there's so much investment and support from the club for the women's programme that there's so much to do, and you know, I'm really looking forward to getting my teeth stuck into a lot of those, whether that's from medical to marketing to our, you know, to education offers for the girls academy to transport options. And I wouldn't say things haven't been done in the past from out of purpose, but but just maybe a slight lack of awareness or understanding, but very much a keenness to learn and improve.
Yeah, and I would definitely echo what you said about the club and its community feeling, its support for the women's team, because we're going back maybe four years when I made the last visit to see the team, and Paul Barber was there. You know, he's the, for anyone who doesn't know, he's the chief executive and I believe deputy chairman at Brighton and Hove Albion. And Paul's been a great supporter of women's football. And he was actually there. And he wasn't there just as a fan. He was actually walking around talking to people. He was talking to the support people there, also the fans, and just wandering around and making himself very present. And again, that's something else Darren and I would have said to a lot of CEOs or general managers of men's clubs, is that visibility is absolutely fundamental in building an attachment with fans. And it's something that he obviously, you know, does as part of the way he is.
Yeah, that's right. And he's just joined the board of women in football as well. So he's a big advocate for the female game. And the club are in the process of building a dedicated hub for the women's game at the training ground at Lancing. That's a multi-million pound investment that was paused during the first lockdown when builders couldn't build, but now is firmly back on track and due to open in the summer. So that really shows the club's investment for the women's game, and you know, to continue with multi-million pound investments considering the pandemic. So the support of Paul Barber and Tony Bloom has been unwavering.
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, it definitely looks like, you know, that the path that you're on is going to kind of be a microcosm of everything you've learned over these past few years and really push Brighton forward. How do you see the growth of the women's game in the years to come? Obviously, COVID's affecting everybody. And as Darren mentioned, it's going to take some time for us to merge out of the other side. I think, you know, we see that there's a lot more interest and financial interest clearly in the women's game. You know, in the last two or three years, the success of the World Cup in France, there's a lot more money coming into the game. I think there was an interview with Megan Rapinoe a couple of years ago in The Guardian where, and I paraphrase, you know, she said, if all that money does is make little girls, you know, think that we're legends and heroes, that's great. But actually, that's a waste of money. Make me want to come to the game. You know, do you see that as the big challenge moving forward? Just getting people to turn up in person?
Yes. Yeah, it still is a challenge. And the insight that we have shows that it's not that people aren't interested, they're just not aware. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I've been working with our communications team is on shifting our communications to the existing fan base of the men's team to think a bit broader into that sort of new target audience, so the individuals that play once a week. So it's not necessarily a lack of interest, it's more a lack of awareness. So we need to think about how we communicate better. In terms of the future of the women's game, so the 21-22 WSL season will have a new broadcast deal. So there'll be many more matches shown both on pay TV and free to air. So that's a really exciting opportunity. Yeah, and also, I don't think the FA have been too shy about it, but they're looking at the governance model of the Women's Super League and the Women's Championship as well, so that it might be that the ownership of the league shifts away from the FA to an alternative governing body. So I think those two are major shifts potentially for the women's game. So, you know, more ownership potentially for the clubs, or more input on decision-making, more commercial opportunity for each club, potentially freed up if there was a change in ownership as well.
Yeah, one of the things that I did a blog about it or something. I definitely wrote about it at one point at the start of the season, and that there seemed in the WSL quite a gap between the teams at the top and the teams at the bottom. And I think in the first few weeks there were some really big score lines, like sort of 8-0s and 9-1 and that sort of scoreline. And I was worried at the time that gap was getting quite big. Now, again, what's your thoughts on that? And it seems to have narrowed quite a lot as the season's progressed. But I just wondered now we've got you on the podcast, what your thoughts were on that?
Yeah, you're right. It does still happen. It's funny because we lost 7-1 to Manchester City at the weekend. But just prior to Christmas, we lost 1-0 to Chelsea. Mm-hmm. So I think as in the men's game, you can get some shock results and then some really close results as well. So, I mean, invariably the budgets differ massively from the top to the bottom of the WSL, and then equally between the WSL and the Championship, there's a big gap as well. So I think with the brand and the size of the brands that some of the clubs at the top of the league have in comparison to other clubs makes a difference. But really, the amount of investment that is going into the women's game across predominantly Premier League and professional clubs is still so small in comparison to the men's game. Yet, you know, just a small percentage increase of investment can make a big difference. So, yeah, there are differences. That's clear. But yet, you know, the likes of Everton have made a marked improvement this year. Reading are still doing very well, holding their own traditional Championship club. Spurs are fairly newcomers into the women's game and doing well. So there's still quite a bit of flex. Obviously, only 12 teams in the WSL. So, you know, room for growth potentially in terms of the number of teams, the types of teams. So, yeah, there's still quite a bit of flex. But, you know, even after 10 years almost, it's the setup and the number of teams that we have at the moment is quite different to how it started 10 years ago. So I would expect there to be more change in the next 5 to 10 years as well.
Yeah. And when you reflect back over the last 5 to 10 years, I mean, the changes and the giant steps forward have been really remarkable. You know, when you think that in Finland, you know, the National League doesn't even hold the word women in it, you know, and to get to that point in such a short period of time, to have Lewis, obviously rivals in different divisions at the moment, but to be having the same budget for their men's and women's team, you know, and to see just the number of women now in senior broadcasting positions, you know, where I think we can all remember, I think it was Jackie Oakley's first game was a Fulham match. I seem to remember that as a commentator and, you know, to be a household name. There's so much progress being made. I guess the one thing now is just not to be complacent. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. And it seems almost every week there's a new first. You know, if that's a new transfer record, if it's a female referee officiating in the Champions League or the Europa League, you know, there are boundaries being broken, you know, all the time. And that's testament to people working across the women's game. And, you know, long may that continue. So, yeah, there's just so many steps forward being made, and yeah, it's still obviously a long way to go, but it's great to hear of all the advances being made across the globe.
Just finally then, because we're coming to the end of our time, Polly, you've been involved in football for a long time now in lots of different roles, but does anything beat playing?
Well, I can't really proclaim to be the best player, and I was certainly very much an amateur player as well. I have very much missed playing football for the last year or so, so I'm looking forward to getting back, but probably more on a five-a-side level than anything. I don't know, I still get the thrill of signing a new player or making improvements that give better access or opportunity to girls to play. So it's a fine balance, but I think having a kickabout with your mates is quite hard to beat.
No, for us, it's just reassuring to know that you're there. You're there, and you're pushing things forward, and you're using all that experience. But I think I love Darren's question, because fundamentally it goes back to playing. I still dabble now and again in five-a-side, unfortunately. But listen, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Have you got? I mean, the typical day. What are you up to today? What's to come this afternoon?
Well, it's transfer deadline day in the women's game today, so we've got an awful lot of communications going on about individuals.
So I guess one of the things we can look forward to in the women's game is maybe just a couple of years from now, you know, Jim White running around trying to get a comment from somebody coming out the training ground in a car, you know, the old Harry Redknapp moment.
Yeah, I think I did that in the summer, actually, for the WSL. I think that one's been done already, Mark.
I'll take that one off then. Forgive me. Behind the times on that one. But hey, Polly, listen, thanks so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure. You know, we learn so much, Darren and I, when we do these podcasts. And believe it or not, this is the 20th, I think, that we've done, or certainly the 20th that will go out there, so over two seasons. So listen, folks, thank you, Darren. Thank you, Luis, producing as always. Folks, that's it for another episode. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at FanExperienceCo. We're on Instagram at FanExperience.co. And of course, our website can be found at www.FanExperienceCo.com. You can pick up also all of our podcasts on Spotify by searching The Fan Experience Experience. So stay safe, everybody. Stay positive, and we'll see you next time.
The Fan Experience Experience was recorded live. See you next time.